Welcome everybody to CSIS. Thank you so much for coming today. I'm so delighted to see so many of you in this room. And welcome, I want to extend that welcome to those joining online. We usually have many more people joining online from different parts of the world, so welcome to those watching online as well. Just for your information, the live stream video is gonna be available after the event finishes in our CSIS website, so you can, those who couldn't make it today, can rewatch the video later on. My name is Moises Rendon. I'm the Associate Director and Associate Fellow of the Americas Program here at CSIS. This event is part of the Venezuela Initiative that CSIS has been building the last 2 years, trying to shed light on one of the worst man-made humanitarian crises that the region has seen in the modern history. No? And the topic today is very important. And we're going to be talking about the implications of a narco state in Venezuela. Organized crime groups have had in their institutions, under democracies, under political systems, and I have in mind perhaps Mexico, Central America, Colombia back in the 80s and 90s when the Colombian government was fighting the cartels, more recently the FARC and the ELN. But the Venezuelan case really brings a more complex problem, because it's not only that there is organized crime groups present in the Venezuelan territory, but the Venezuelan government is also involved in the narco-trafficking business and either involved directly or complicit with the narco-trafficking activities and other illicit activities. No? And we're going to be discussing that's also part of the discussion. And this is why we brought perhaps two of the brightest strategic, thoughtful minds when it comes to the Venezuelan crisis. We're very honor Ambassador Brownfield and Juan Zarate to join us for this topic, and thank you again for your time and contribution to all this Venezuelan crisis since the beginning, right? So thank you again. I usually don't like to go over the bias, but I think this event deserves to make sure that everyone in this room and those watching online understand the depth of the background of the two speakers that we have today related to the Venezuelan crisis. So briefly, Ambassador Brownfield is a senior advisor here at CSIS. Thank you, Ambassador, for your time and commitment.
Uncompensated senior advisor.
He always says that.
You're being very generous with your time to CSIS. Thank you, Ambassador. He was the U.S. ambassador to Chile in 2002 to 2004. He was the U.S. ambassador to Venezuela from 2004 to 2007, and then to Colombia in 2007 to 2010. Just to put into perspective, Ambassador Brownfield ran the embassy in Colombia of 4,000 employees and a $1 billion budget supporting an enormous range of military, security, law enforcement, economic, and humanitarian programs with the Colombian government, right?
Smaller budget in Venezuela.
In Venezuela, he led an embassy in constant crisis, and I'm not surprised because of the rough environment there. And as ambassador to Chile, he managed a sophisticated relationship with a mature and stable government, leading to the first free trade agreement in Latin America since NAFTA in 1993. More recently, he was assistant secretary for drugs and law enforcement, the INL at the State Department, from 2011 until 2017, just last year, and running a portfolio of more than 80 countries. His responsibilities range from police training, assisting in Afghanistan, Iraq, massive anti-drug efforts in Colombia, Mexico, crisis management in Central America, police development in the Palestine West Bank, to maritime law enforcement in the South China Sea, and stopping the flow of heroin and fentanyl into the United States. Ambassador, thank you for your service. Your background really demonstrates that I don't know there is a person better qualified to talk about this topic than you, so thank you again for joining us for this event.
I hope CSIS is getting their money's worth for my participation.
We're working on that. Juan Zarate, colleague and friend, thank you. Delighted, honored to have you here too.
Thank you.
Juan is a senior advisor here at CSIS. Thank you for your generous time to CSIS.
Thank you.
He's also a chairman and co-founder of the Financial Integrity Network, a visiting professor at Harvard Law School. He also served as chairman and senior counselor for the Foundation for Defense of Democracy's Center on Sanctions and Illicit Finance. Mr. Zarate served as a deputy assistant to the president and deputy national security advisor for combating terrorism from 2005 to 2009. He was responsible for developing and implementing the US government counterterrorism strategies and policies for transnational security threats. And lastly, he was the very first Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Terrorist Finance and Financial Crimes, a topic that is highly relevant right now respecting to the Venezuelan crisis. So thank you, Juan, again.
Thank you,
and he also earned the numerous awards for his work, including the Treasury Medal. So thank you, Juan.
Thank you,
delighted to having you.
Thank you.
Great okay, so let's get this start. Let's get started just for how things will run. Each of the speakers are going to provide brief remarks. Then we're going to have a conversation between the three of us. And then we're going to open it up for Q&A at the end. So be patient. We're going to get to the questions at the end. But with that, Ambassador, I want to give you the floor and thank you again for being with us. Thank you.
You're just doing that to draw greater attention to the fact that I was perhaps the last one to arrive and apparently the only one in this entire room who had written down on his calendar that this event started at 11 and not at 10:30. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a pleasure, as always, to be with you here at CSIS. The reason I continue to say I'm an uncompensated senior advisor, by the way, in its defense, CSIS has been generous enough to give me an office and a computer here. That's the extent of their generosity, however, although a telephone may be in the works. Ladies and gents, you're going to, as often happens when I speak, you're going to have to bear with me while I do my historical overview from a personal perspective. And I promise it will not take me too long to get to the basic point. I first arrived in Venezuela for the first time as a brand new, as in just in the Foreign Service, vice consul in the city of Maracaibo, the western state of Zulia, mm-hmm. in 1979, where I remained for 2 years. What would have been the assessment of this 25 to 27-year-old young man at that time as to transnational organized crime, the co-opting of institutions and corruption, I would have said, and I still think I was largely right, I would have said the following. Is there corruption in the late 70s, early 80s in Venezuela? Of course there was. You only had to walk the streets and go into government buildings to see some of the impact of that. I would also have said, however, it is not controlling in the society, the community, and the institutions. I would have gone so far as to say, in my opinion, it would be about in the middle, average, if you will, for the Western Hemisphere at that point in time. I would have described the institutions, the security institutions, the National Guard, what we then called the PTJ, and I've now forgotten what they're called now, roughly the investigatory police of Venezuela, DECIP, which is now called SEBIN, with all three of which I had very regular engagements as the vice consul responsible for visiting every jail in all of Western Venezuela to call upon American citizens currently in incarceration. And I would have said, while these institutions are inefficient, and while there is some small-time corruption, they nevertheless have not been completely taken over and co-opted by corrupt players and individuals. I would have said, the nation, the people, there would be great popular frustration with the institutions and much criticism of corruption, of inefficiency. They would have talked about unequal treatment. They would have talked about slow justice and investigations. They would have grumbled about, at best, trickle-down benefits from these institutions. But there was not a sense of crisis. There was not a sense of being overwhelmed by drug trafficking, by money laundering, by larger transnational organized crime, and the then largest and most important institution in Venezuela as today, PDVSA, was actually, an institution that worked fairly well. By 79, this was, Pedro, you would know, was it 3 years after nationalization since the 76 nationalization? And the truth of the matter is, PDVSA in those days, it had regional subparts, Maraven, Lagoven, etc., but they were working pretty much like a professional oil industry. That's how I left Maracaibo, or those are the thoughts that I had as I left Maracaibo in 1981. Well, let's flash forward, shall we? 37 years later, it is now 2018. What might my observations be right now? PDVSA, once I would have said a professional oil company, now is responsible for laundering billions, that is multiples of billions, of dollars every single year through its financial system and its financial network. Drug movements through the country, which in my era I would have said totaled probably less than one metric ton between 79 and 81. Now I would estimate somewhere between 50 and 100 tons a year. And ladies and gents, that's progress. 10 years ago, I would have told you it was much closer to 200 tons a year. And that is not just drug movement, that is a drug crisis. I would say all of the government's programs, their social programs, their medical programs, their educational programs, are not just riddled with corruption, they are completely co-opted by criminal players. I would say today that all of the security forces, the armed forces, the military, the National Guard, but as well as the police and Sabine, the security and intelligence organization, are completely corrupted, not just from the inside, but by outside players such as drug trafficking organizations. I would note that there's, to all intents and purposes, no foreign direct investment today in Venezuela, reflecting a complete and utter lack of confidence, with the exception of the two economic godfathers, the Russian Federation and China. I would say today that there is no rule of law, no transparency, and quite frankly, no security on the streets, in the communities, and for that matter, in the businesses of Venezuela. I would note and challenge anyone to challenge this statement that 1 to 2 million Venezuelans are voluntarily converting themselves into refugees every year at this point in time, October of 2018. I would note that Venezuela now has the proud title of being the source of more maritime piracy in the Caribbean and the Western Atlantic than any other nation in the world. I would say that its institutions are not just corrupted, they are co-opted. I would say that Venezuela today is not a narco state, because it is probably something worse. I am calling it, as we have called it in describing this conference, a mafia state, which goes beyond just drug trafficking. It is also a hub for financial crime. It is a hub, obviously, for money laundering. It is a hub for virtually any sort of smuggling and trafficking in which a criminal organization can make money. So that, ladies and gentlemen, is my assessment of the difference between 1981, when I left Venezuela the first time, and 2018, where we all are today. What happened? Let me offer you 9 suggestions. In no particular order, I stopped at 9 so no one would accuse me of trying to compete with the 10 commandments or some other sort of holy number like 10. Here are some suggestions. One, since the arrival of the current government in January of 1999, government and its institutions have emphasized ideology and loyalty over competence. And after this many years, that's more than 20, by the way, that has an inevitable impact on the competence of the institutions. Second, in perhaps the most important institutions in terms of enforcement of the law, rules, and regulations, competence is not the route to promotion and recognition. On the contrary, it at times is the way not to get yourself promoted, because it draws attention to senior or superior officers who perhaps do not fall into the competence category. Mm-hmm. What is the impact? Duh, yet more reason not to project basic professionalism and competence. Third, Mr. Chavez and his revolution came in honestly stating they were going to destroy the institutions of the ancien regime, of the evil, corrupt, the escuálidos, sounds even cooler in Spanish, los escuálidos of the 1980s and the 1990s, which they did. I was there present when the Supreme Court of Venezuela magically grew from 20 justices to 30 without bothering the National Assembly to have to worry about who the additional 10 would be, since their names were provided only about 30 minutes before the vote on them. And suddenly, the Supreme Court, instead of being divided 50-50 between, if you will, those that were sympathetic to the opposition and those that were sympathetic to the government, magically became two-thirds in favor of the government. When the National Assembly had zero members of the opposition in it, the National Assembly played a very important role. When the National Assembly suddenly had, well, for a while, a good number of opposition members, and then a majority of opposition members, the National Assembly was just kind of dismissed, and so on down the road. In other words, was he honest when he said he was going to destroy the vestiges of the old institutions? Yes. He replaced them with hacks, or he did not replace them at all. Idea number four, Mr. Chavez clearly made a decision. He made it sometime in the 2005 timeframe, I would argue, that he would definitively reject cooperation with the West writ large. And he put the United States foremost in that group, but he terminated cooperation on drug trafficking, on matters related to financial crime, on matters related to international criminal investigation. As a consequence, since that time, and we're now at about the 13th going on 14th year, there is effectively no cooperation with or within Venezuela by outside players on drugs, on money laundering, on financial crime, on larger transnational organized crime. And that has an inevitable effect in terms of how attractive Venezuela does or does not look to an outside criminal presence or criminal organization. Fifth, the three godfathers of the current regime, the governments of the Republic of Cuba, the Russian Federation, and China, have stressed, and I think as a matter of policy, continuation as more important than legitimacy, or for that matter, professionalism and competence. One can understand that. One could make accusations that other governments, I could even make those accusations now that I no longer work for a government, have done the same sort of calculation in years past or even at present. My only point is that it has an inevitable impact on Venezuela as itself if its three principal support mechanisms have chosen not to attempt, encourage, or suggest legitimacy, competence, and professionalism as important elements in the government and government institutions. Sixth or seventh or fifth, wherever I am right now, Hugo Chavez, if he were still alive today, could he, if he were in proper health, be able to force some sort of consensus within his movement up to and including cleaning up some elements? Yeah, maybe he could. I have my doubts, but at least I am open to that. What I am not open to is any suggestion that the current government has that authority, has that credibility, has that ability to bring the entire movement of Chavismo together on a difficult point. Seventh, yeah, I'm counting them now. The government of Venezuela made a conscious decision in the early 2000s to support, directly and indirectly, the FARC, the Fuerzas Armadas, shit, I've now forgotten how we say it in English, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, and the Army of National Liberation, the ELN, of Colombia, in Venezuela. One impact of that political decision, that ideological decision, that philosophical decision was it brought with them drug trafficking organizations. My argument would be that the FARC itself was a drug trafficking organization, but those that were actually not members of the FARC found that they now had a secure base of operations in Venezuela. In fact, with considerable security provided by large numbers and armed elements of the FARC and the ELN. Eighth, PDVSA, the piggy bank, the moneymaker, the only institution that actually delivered revenue to the government of Venezuela for decades, was gutted between 2002 and 2004. Created initially by the oil workers' strike, but the response by the government of the then president Chavez was to absolutely gut the management levels, the leadership, the professionals of PDVSA. And since PDVSA was then, is now, and I predict for years to come will remain the principal piggy bank for the government of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela, it should not surprise anyone that it then became a very attractive target for those involved in financial crime and money laundering. And finally, I'll make the obvious point. If you have no institutions, if you have no oversight, if you have no enforcement, it is inevitable that the basic human trait that Adam Smith described back in the 18th century, and that is greed, will eventually take control over individuals. If there is no reason not to be corrupt, it takes a very strong person to resist corruption in its totality. Ladies and gentlemen, I make a prediction. 50 years from now, doctoral candidates in universities around the world will write their dissertations on Venezuela, a textbook case on how a nation converts into a mafia state. End of my presentation, Moises. Back to you. Whoever you might wish to call upon.
Thank you, Ambassador. Thank you so much. Juan, let's go straight to you, and then we can get into a conversation.
Thank you, Moises. I'll be brief because I, you know, following the legendary Bill Brownfield's a difficult act to follow, and I'm a huge fan of this. But Moises, thank you for inviting me. And there are a ton of real experts who could be sitting up here instead of me in the audience. It's really an honor to be here. Let me just feed off of what Bill has just laid out because he's done it. With his natural enthusiasm and energy.
Zest? Did you say zest?
Zest, maybe zest. But let me make 3 points here, or at least inquire on 3 areas. One is to talk a little bit more about this evolution that Bill has talked about, because I think there's a spectrum around the world with respect to governments that are engaged in criminality, be it financial criminality, narco trafficking, other types of crimes like smuggling. There's kind of a spectrum. And the low end of the spectrum, of course, is where you have willful ignorance or willful blindness with respect to enforcement, lack of capacity. On the other end, frankly, is what we have with Venezuela, which is the organs of the state and the institution and the very ideology of the country now ingrained in criminality of all the forms that Bill has laid out. And I think we are reaching that sort of that end of the spectrum is incredibly dangerous, not only for Venezuela and its institutions, but also for the region and the very enabling and empowering of the networks that they're interacting with. And so I think it's important to keep that in mind, because it's often very easy to slip into looking at various regimes around the world, lack of transparency, corruption on the Transparency International list, and sort of losing the thread as to how you can evaluate one regime against another. I do think, as Bill laid out, we're on the outer extreme here with Venezuela in terms of how they've operated. So I'll just touch briefly on why I think that is and why I think it's important. Second thing I want to touch on is why this is so dangerous outside the borders of Venezuela, right? We obviously understand the corrosive nature, the dangerous elements of this within Venezuela and what it means for the population and the government, but also what it means regionally, what it means in terms of the transnational groups that profit, that benefit from what Venezuela is doing. I'll do that very briefly. And then finally, maybe touch on the U.S. approach, because my sort of prior experience at the U.S. Treasury and in the White House dealing with counterterrorism and transnational threats has seen an evolution of how the U.S. has thought about these issues. And frankly, how the U.S. approach has evolved along with the perception of this evolution that Bill has laid out. And maybe explain just briefly what has animated the enforcement actions, the investigations, and even the evolving sanctions regime that we've seen to date. And maybe give a couple of insights there. So if that's okay, I'll
Sounds
do this
great.
Very briefly.
Yes.
I think one of the most interesting parts about that spectrum of Venezuela as a narco or a mafia state is the fact that over time, the Venezuelan regime realized that not only could it profit from the illicit trade and the narco trafficking in the region, but it could use the very essence of that trade and the organizations themselves to actually drive control. And so it was the duality of the ability to profit from these networks over time and to organize them and to be more centrally a part of how the networks operated in and through Venezuela, but also thinking about how those networks could then empower elements of the state to control at the micro level with the mega bandas and the other organizations that then tied into political control. And so that recognition became a very important sort of part of the evolution that we saw, that Roger Noriega and others saw when we were working on these issues. I think one key element, and Bill alluded to this, the canary in the coal mine for me was in 2005, when the Venezuelan government kicked the DEA out. For all of us who've worked in government and worked in Latin America and seen sort of the relations with DEA, obviously those are complicated relationships, but at a moment when you have the DEA being kicked out, when you have a restructuring of what cooperation with the U.S. looks like, it's a moment of awakening where you have to look at what happens thereafter. And I think what happened thereafter was, again, the Venezuelan state beginning to co-opt the networks of illicit traffic and narco trafficking more directly. And so what you've seen from that point on was the involvement of senior government leadership, senior military leadership, not just in casting a blind eye to what's happening, but in actual controlling and profiting from the networks and organizing those networks and then enabling them. What they've also done is to enable and use all elements of the government. And this is the danger of that extreme of the spectrum. That is to say, not just the use of the National Guard or even law enforcement to enable these groups, but the intelligence services to gather intelligence, the use of financial intelligence to understand who has money, who is flowing money to whom, what those networks look like to be able to exploit and extort for government purposes. The ability to use border agencies to then facilitate what happens in and out. The ability to use customs services, tax services to bring cases, investigations. Bringing the full weight, and not to mention the diplomatic corps, right, and the elements of cover that gives internationally and regionally. So what you had in that period was a recognition that all of the organs of the state could then be used to facilitate the activities of narco trafficking, to not only profit but then to control further those networks and control internal political developments. What you then had, which is my second point, is an enabling of these networks in a much more powerful way, in part because they were protected, in part because they were joint schemes to be able to profit from the various narco channels that were being established. For example, movement of cocaine and other drugs into Mexico in concert with Los Zetas, the ability to coordinate with FARC and ELN in terms of transshipment from Colombia through Venezuela, working with narco trafficking and shipment groups to move drugs into the Caribbean, into the Dominican Republic. And so an enabling of these networks that began to empower those networks themselves because they now had a state that was backing them, empowering them, profiting with them. In addition, you had the very real problem in that period, 2005, 2006, yeah, of the beginning relations or the deepening of the relations with Iran, even with Hezbollah, and some of the Treasury actions later in 2008 and beyond began to expose some of those networks, including the money laundering and terrorist financing networks tied to the Ayman Juma network and money laundering that was attendant to the drug trafficking, but also tied to some of these terrorist groups that had regional and global implications. And so part of this evolution, this movement to the end of the spectrum, was also an empowerment of these groups at a time, by the way, when in Colombia there was an attempt to constrict the power of the FARC, an attempt by the U.S. to constrict the reach of the FARC in terms of its drug trafficking efforts. Maybe just a final point then with respect to the U.S. approach, because for a long time, certainly during our tenure, there was a sense that we didn't want to poke the hornet's nest, so to speak, with aggressive U.S. sanctions. That is to say, let's not make the same mistake that happened in the minds of some in the Cuba program, where the sanctions program was used as the boogeyman to explain all the government's ills and bad decisions and mismanagement. And so for a time, there was a sense that we could manage and deal with the Venezuelan government without having to resort to the most powerful economic and financial tools of exclusion, which ultimately were the strategies employed. And so what you had starting in 2007, 2008 was a recognition that Venezuelan regime behavior couldn't be ignored with respect to a set of transnational threats that were of deep national security import to the United States. So obviously you had the ties to international drug trafficking. You had greater attention to organized crime and organized crime activity that was considered a national security concern. You obviously had concerns on terrorist financing, et cetera. And even in 2008, 2009, seen most recently in executive orders signed in recent years, a focus on high-end corruption, kleptocracy, and human rights abuses that form part of core national security interests. And so not only was there a recognition that things were devolving in Venezuela and we had to be more aggressive about how we thought about the use of these tools, but the very nature of Venezuelan behavior, regime behavior, that touched all of these other issues that were of national security import really began to reshape U.S. policy in the use of these tools, which then explains what you've seen with U.S. enforcement actions and sanctions. And so you've seen high-level Venezuelan officials designated as drug kingpins and pursuant to new authorities for corruption and human rights abuses, mirrored to a certain extent in that regard by the European Union. You've had designations tied to terrorist financing as well. You have had indictments and investigations tied to broader conspiracies, tied to organized crime and narcotics trafficking organizations. And so what you've had is a targeting of the regime on a broader basis based on the regime's activity itself, and it's tied to these other national security issues of concern. In addition, what's been interesting is the use of sanctions in a more direct way to deal with the underlying way that the regime has tried to profit from the very corruption and illicit activity that we're talking about. And so what you see with the sanctions is an attempt to cabin around the Venezuelan economy, not in a way to ultimately destroy it. So these sanctions aren't built to destroy PDVSA, for example, but they're built to try to cabin how the regime itself profits from what PDVSA is doing, frankly, what Citgo is doing here in the United States, how it is that debt and equity is offered to the government, how the marketplace reacts to Venezuelan bonds, the rejection of the Venezuelan petro, the cryptocurrency. And so an entire regime that's been evolving to try to cabin and contain the ability of the regime to profit from its corruption, its extortion, and ties to narcotics trafficking. You will continue to see this, I think. You will continue to see not only targeting of regime officials, senior leadership, senior military officials that are part of running these organizations, but you're going to see continued nuanced use of financial sanctions and regulations to try to cabin the way that the regime is trying to work around these sanctions and around these controls. And the big question here is, how do you deal with PDVSA? As Bill mentioned, not only an engine of the economy, but at this point, an engine for money laundering and illicit activity, and a systemically relevant institution as well, and one that you want to survive a post-Maduro environment, if one can imagine that. And so this grows more complicated, not less. What the Venezuelan government, in becoming a mafia state, has done is to put itself right in the middle of the financial and enforcement crosshairs of the United States and even others like the EU. And I think the big question is, how deep and how far does this go? And how much does the regime take advantage of the dislocation, chaos, and economic problems as a way of furthering its control and furthering its ability to profit? What we've learned over time with regimes, be it the Iraqi regime, the Cuban regime, any regime that is under stress internationally, where the economy is faltering, where it's under sanctions control, they will try to control more and more parts of the economy, to include the illicit economy, to try to profit and control the polity. You'll continue to see that, I think, in Venezuela. And the question then is, what do we do about it? Thank you, Moses.
Thank you, Juan. Thank you, Ambassador, again. I think we covered a lot of issues here. And not to mention that Venezuela is also facing the worst humanitarian crisis that the region has seen, no, in the modern history. I mean, there are 2.5 million refugees fleeing the country in the last few years, more millions expected to flee the country. So this is a very complex crisis. It's kind of a perfect storm type of crisis, no? And Venezuela is right in the middle of it, but the region is also now getting affected, as you both mentioned it. I want to go back to a couple of points that were made, but first I want to get Ambassador's thoughts on an issue that I think is relevant for many in Venezuela, for many in the region, that I don't think it has been answered as clear yet. And this is based, this is information is based on the Bureau for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, the office that the Ambassador just led until last year. They issue a report this year from 2018 called International Narcotics Control Strategy Report, where they
INCSR, as the cool guys call it. INCSR.
The nerds call it.
Right. So they classify, the U.S. Department of State classifies Venezuela, right, as a major illicit drug producing, as three things: a major illicit drug producing and major drug transit country, a major precursor chemical source country, and a major money laundering country. All three of the possible categories that the report has. So Ambassador, in addition to these labels, which are very relevant, very important, will the US government, now that we've seen and everything that both of you talk, the involvement of the Venezuelan government on narco-trafficking and other illicit activities, will the U.S. government consider label Venezuela as a narco state, and what would be the implications for that? Is there a U.S. law that has that? Is a policy within the U.S. government, and what would be the implications either way for that label?
The International Narcotics Control Strategy Report, the INCSR, is by law, it serves as the basis for a determination that is made once a year, where all the countries that have been identified as either major producers or major transit countries are assessed. In the old days, we called this the certification process. Certification annoyed, correctly, in my opinion, a large number of countries, like nearly 100%, who found it somewhat arrogant that one nation would assess and provide a report card on all the other nations of the world without them having input. They eventually did have some input through the OAS system, but nevertheless, it was annoying. So about 15 years ago, the United States Congress correctly simplified the process. We're still kind of saying what is our assessment of what is happening around the world right now, but there is only one basic category that is a finger-pointing category, and that is determining whether a nation has, quote, failed demonstrably in complying with their international obligations on drug-related matters, close quote. Now, if the question that you were to ask me is, do I believe that it would be possible, perhaps even correct, to make such a determination about Venezuela right now, the answer, of course, is yes. But in fact, in defense of INL, my former place of employment, we had made that determination for a number of years. We merely offered a national interest waiver, which the law also permits, should the president conclude that it is in the national interest of the United States of America to waive the application of the statute in this particular instance. And there have been, and that was a decision, by the way, that was not made by INL. That was made by other parts of the United States government. Part of them, I believe, were assessing and considering whether this would contribute or harm possible dialogue, whether this would contribute to or harm the ability to support other organizations, institutions inside of Venezuela. Mm-hmm. I was never robustly enthusiastic about the national interest waiver that I think has been issued now for, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years. I'd have to go look it up as to how long it's been going on. But the simple answer to your question is yes, I believe there is more than enough factual basis to make a determination that the government of Venezuela has failed demonstrably in its obligations or in complying with international standards, UN-based as well as cooperation with the United States.
Yes, Moises, comment on this, because the INCSA report's incredibly valuable, and if folks haven't read it, it's important to read. But what happens at times is because of these categorizations, what you get, as I said earlier, is a bit of a blending and a lack of appreciation of the qualitative difference of what we're talking about with Venezuela, right?
So sure, yeah.
There are always questions of capacity of countries to deal with these issues, right? Mm-hmm. And that creates risk and deficit unto itself. And so you may have a government that wants to do more, they just can't. They're not good enough. We're not there to facilitate, others aren't, right? So there's a question of capacity. There's a question of will. Sometimes governments have other priorities or other reasons that they don't want to, you know, focus on this. Fine, they're angry at the U.S., maybe. And then you've got the sort of the final category, which is governments that are actively co-opting and driving the actual illicit activity. You know, that's where we are with Venezuela. And I think we need to be very clear about that, because in some ways, again, it's almost off the charts when you talk about sort of the INCSA report, or you talk about other ways that we evaluate countries, right? This isn't just another corrupt country because there's a corrupt culture like in many places. This is endemic to both the ideology of the government. It's part of the political establishment now, and it's being run by the government. So I think that's really important to keep in mind. The challenge, of course, is what are the consequences? Because everyone, regardless of objection, looks to these U.S. reports as a clarifying set of documents around risk, right? And so when Treasury comes out with their designations, when the Justice Department comes out with their indictments, when the State Department issues their reports, not only are other governments looking at this, but the market players are looking at this. And what's interesting and important for Venezuela is what comes next, because you have sort of conflicting policy goals, frankly, Moises. A core sort of instinct here is, well, you need to then isolate, undermine, and constrain the reach and capabilities of this regime. And that's clear. That's obvious. We have to do that. At the same time, you have to allow the economy to function because the people are suffering. And so you have to have ways of moving capital and goods in and out. So you're not talking about strangling the economy. Mm-hmm. And you also then have to worry about what comes next, as I was alluding to earlier. You can't engage in such a powerful constriction campaign, whether it's regionally or globally or just driven by the United States, that kills the institutions that will be important to kind of what comes next in the rejuvenation of, hopefully, the Venezuelan economy and society. So it's fascinating here, because one of the questions and consequences of the report is, okay, what is to be done from mm-hmm. this, and how do you imagine risk? And one arena here is the Treasury Department should obviously be looking at the use of other authorities, for example, Section 311 of the Patriot Act, which allows the Treasury to designate primary money laundering concerns, including jurisdictions, right? The Treasury has used this effectively against Iran, against the Central Bank of Iran. It's held out as a countermeasure largely against foreign banks that present real risk to the U.S. financial system. But with the INCSA report, with everything that we're talking about, with all of the designations, there is a fundamental question as to whether or not Venezuela as a whole is a primary money laundering concern. Is everything in and out of Venezuela at this point suspect and taint, such that U.S. and other financial institutions have to take note, have to engage in enhanced due diligence, and even if a transaction isn't prohibited technically, it should, you know, meet very high standards and criteria because of the lack of transparency and accountability, and precisely because of the corruption we're talking about here.
Yeah, thank you, Juan. On that same line, Juan, I you wrote this great book called The Treasury's War, Unleashing Treasury, the New Era of Financial Warfare. I think it's a great book. It's one of my favorite. As soon as I got here in CSAS, I read it, and
thank you, Moises.
Really, really good book.
Well, that's why I like you so much.
Will the movie be coming out soon, Juan?
I'm hoping you star in it.
I recommend all of you to read it if you haven't read it. But the campaign, you wrote something on that book that kept to my mind until today, and I, you know, was waiting for this opportunity to ask you.
Okay.
You wrote that the campaign against Korea had direct and immediate impact, the U.S. sanction campaign against Korea, against North Korea. And in the wake of the financial crisis, North Korea hadn't, or any other country, hasn't seen an international financial pressure as what the U.S. did against North Korea. And in fact, the North Korea found its bank accounts and illicit financial activities in jeopardy in 2013. And a North Korean, you wrote it, a deputy negotiator at the time quietly admitted to a senior White House official, "You finally found a way to hurt us." So you have the full view of the war, of how to use the U.S. financial power to increase pressure on repressive regimes like that of North Korea. Now we have one in Venezuela, who is also sanctioned by the U.S. Mm-hmm. under corruption, money laundering, narco-trafficking, human rights abuses. But we haven't really seen a change of behavior yet from the Venezuelan regime. But we know it's hurting them, and they have admitted it in different ways. So my question is, how much financial pressure will be needed to make the Venezuelan regime change of behavior under that sanctioned regime using the U.S. financial power structures?
You've asked the billion-dollar questions when it comes to sanctions and sort of their effectiveness, right? And the question of what are we trying to achieve with these kinds of tools and campaigns? And ultimately, can you use these tools in concert with other tools, diplomacy, law enforcement, other pressure, to actually change behavior and change the trajectory of a regime? One size doesn't fit all, right? Every country regime is different. So North Korea is very different from Iran. That's very different from Russia. That's very different from Venezuela. And so I don't think there's an easy answer. Part of the challenge here is I don't think sanctions and financial pressure alone will change the minds of those that are most ideologically committed in this regime. And I think the challenge with the use of these tools with sort of ideologically grounded governments, less pragmatic governments, is it's harder to change their minds by affecting their pocketbook only, right? There are other things that need and can be done. So I'm not sure that in the Venezuelan context, as in even the Iranian context, that sanctions and financial pressure alone will change behavior and change policy trajectory. That's not to say that it's not important and that it can't be not only a key driver, but even a catalyst for change. But it has to fundamentally affect their ability to govern and their ability to profit and engage in activity. This is in part, Moises, why the regime's activity in the illicit space is so challenging and also so so dangerous. That is to say, the illicit markets provide them alternate sources of revenue. The illicit markets are harder to control. Illicit markets tied to smuggling and cross-border trade that they are facilitating and controlling, very hard to penetrate and disrupt, right? So the moment you have a nation state engaged in the elements of criminality and trying to profit from it, it's very difficult, other than maximum pressure, enforcement, regional attention, interdictions, blocking of assets, all of that together, it's very hard to affect. So this is not easy. Mm-hmm. And again, as I said, the final element of the Venezuelan equation that makes this very hard is PDVSA and the oil trade, right? How much do you want to squeeze and cut off that trade? We made that decision in the Iranian context that's where we were going. We were going in terms of the banking sector, going after the central bank ultimately, and the banks that were being used to move money for terrorists and engage in illicit finance. We were going after the shipping lines and the transport that they were using to do all sorts of things. We were going after the insurance sector that they relied upon to engage in international activity. But ultimately, we had to go after their oil, right? And so that, in many ways, is the final leg of this question of financial and economic pressure with Venezuela. Mm-hmm. And how we do that, you've seen the Treasury try to modulate, how we do that really then determines, I think, ultimately, how the regime responds.
Moises, may I just add on? Yeah. Actually, unusually, I agree 100% with what Dr. Sarate has just said. May I add one additional point? I'll personalize it once again. I came back to Washington from Colombia in August of 2010. At that time, the debate over what, how, whether, how much to sanction Venezuela focused on impact on the U.S. economy and economic interests, and the possibility of somehow or other leveraging a positive political outcome on the ground in Venezuela between government and government supporters and opposition. I myself disagreed almost completely with that particular assessment as the basis for making the decision. Expressed my view a few times, but like, what was her name, Cassandra, who was condemned to spend her entire life predicting the truth, but no one would ever listen to her or believe her. Or even better, John the Baptist preaching in the desert for 40 years, but having nothing but sand listening to me, I did not succeed in convincing my audience that we should focus on something else. We have gotten beyond that now. I do not believe anyone is seriously saying we should not sanction, change sanctions, ratchet up sanctions, adjust sanctions because of the possible impact it might have on the relationship between the government of Venezuela and the government of the United States of America. Good news. What the debate now is, and this is a legitimate debate, is the impact on the people of Venezuela. In other words, how hard do we want the international community writ large? Do we want to sanction Venezuela? How much increased malnutrition, lack of medicine, impact on the public health system? How much impact is that going to have? Now, that is a valid argument to have. That's a legitimate issue. And no one in this room can't tell me that you don't have friends or, in some cases, family in Venezuela that actually has to have some impact as you decide how hard do we want to apply the screws to Venezuela in terms of the impact it is going to have on the people of Venezuela. My own view, thank you for asking, is we should treat this as a bit of agony, a tragedy that's going to go on until it's finally brought to an end. And if we can do something that will bring that end quicker, we probably should do it. But we should do it understanding that it's going to have an impact on millions and millions of people who are already having great difficulty finding enough to eat, getting themselves cured when they get sick, or are finding clothes to put on their children before they go off to school. We don't get to do this and pretend as though it has no impact there. We have to make the hard decision. The desired outcome justifies this fairly severe punishment. I can make that argument, but don't let anyone tell you that you don't have to address that issue. Thank you for letting me emote.
Sure. on that score, it bears mentioning, if you look at the current sanctions, obviously there are there's a license for medicine and agricultural products, as you tend to have humanitarian exemptions for most sanctions programs. So that's important. But it does raise an interesting question. Moises, we've talked about this and started to work on this together, in terms of thinking about what a positive set of economic tools may look like to actually relieve the pressure and the needs of the people, and to do so in a way that is outside the bounds and control of the government itself, and meets the goals of transparency, accountability, and sanctions enforcement, right? And so one of the interesting things, and you've written about this, is the emergence of a crypto economy, not the petro, not the crypto economy that the government's trying to control and foster and use as sort of a very odd and I think ineffective backstop to the economic slide. But so the organic crypto space that's emerging with the NGOs and others that are trying to move resources effectively into Venezuela at a time when the currency, I don't even know how much it's devalued at this point. I've lost track, and at a rate of 1,000,000% inflation, you know, whatever the IMF is estimating at this point, it's ridiculous. But it's a real interesting question, and you've articulated in your piece around whether or not we can think about particular channels or ecosystems that we can facilitate, we being sort of the international community, that then allows goods to go in, allows financing to go in, but in ways that are not controlled by the Maduro regime, and whether or not crypto currencies can actually be a conduit, right? It's happening organically anyway, right? You've seen these markets emerge in Medellin and parts of Colombia along the border areas. The NGO community is airdropping, money in via crypto into people's accounts at a micro level. So some very interesting organic developments. And so it raises an interesting question. I challenge, our U.S. government colleagues to think creatively about this. What are some positive ways of impacting that then give you levers that are outside the bounds of the current government control? Because as I said, the problem with everything we're talking about here is the government has used the economy, the organs of state, the illicit networks as an element of control politically and to profit financially. If you can create alternate channels or ecosystems, that could be a very interesting corollary to a pressure campaign to affect the regime.
Thank you. Well, no, definitely. The use of cryptocurrency in Venezuela is something that we all need to look at, because it's happening. Venezuela is the third country that has the most transactions on Bitcoin in the world. And that trend is only going to increase. The IMF is predicting 10,000,000% of inflation.
Yeah, I lost track. I'm sorry.
Next year. So it's something that we all need to look at. It's a tool to empower the Venezuelan people, too. It's not only for humanitarian aid purposes, which is, as you mentioned, is happening organically and it's only going to increase, but it's also a tool to empower the Venezuelan people. And it's those independent cryptocurrencies that has the potential to help. Not the petro, not those closed environment and ecosystem cryptocurrency, but those independent that are outside of the regime control. Yeah. And that's something, go ahead.
Just full disclosure, I'm an advisor at Coinbase, but I'm not advertising this for Coinbase purposes.
Yeah.
It's actually made me more aware of what's happening in this space as a result. But I want to make sure people know that so we don't think we're doing a commercial update.
Thank you, Juan. Let's get one more question before we move to the audience, Ambassador and Juan, and it's the question of the day after, right? We all see this crisis developing in a way that we know that the day after is going to be very challenging. Well, now you mentioned, Ambassador, and I have here on my notes, there is no rule of law in Venezuela, there is no transparency, security is one of the biggest problems. On top of that, you have a mafia state. Let's move beyond the narco state. Mafia state now doing a lot of illicit activities. So the question really is, and it's going to sound a little bit too simple, but I think we all need to think about it. How possible is to restore Venezuela's democracy during a day after a scenario in front of a mafia state that is involved in so many illicit activities?
A fair question, and I will offer you my kind of mental construct in terms of how to address the problem. And I will pick my words carefully. I am aware that I'm speaking not just to this august group here, all of whom are extremely intelligent, brilliant, and able to carefully assess everything that I say, but perhaps to others outside. So I'll be careful in selecting my words. My assessment is that there is a two-step process that eventually must occur. One step is we, the international community, and this is not just those who live in this country, whose national headquarters we are sitting in right now, the city of Washington, but the other 60 or 80 countries of the planet that are impacted to some extent by what is happening in Venezuela. We have to reach the conclusion, if we have not already, that this problem will, this tragedy, this crisis, let me get it in the right order, this problem, crisis, tragedy will not be resolved until there is either a change in government or a massive restructuring and reorganization of that government in a way that is the equivalent of a change in government. So one track has to be how we, the international community, encourage that outcome. However that may be, we must accept that. And everything else that we're talking about then is a matter of tactics. Dialogue, no dialogue. Elections, no elections. Sanctions, no sanctions. What they are is tactical tools to play into the question of how do we, the international community, encourage this outcome. The second track then is, all right, when that outcome occurs, what is, as you call it, as I call it, the plan for the day after? There would be no greater tragedy than everyone basically working to produce the desired outcome, a change in government, and then absolutely no one is ready to support what the change would then become. I mean, talk about a huge deception to however many millions of Venezuelans who might still remain in the country at that time. I could think of nothing more tragic than that. So the planning for the day after, and the two are related, obviously. Mm-hmm. For example, I believe some sort of massive humanitarian package has to be part of planning for the day after. I see absolutely no reason why you could not use it as well as part of the effort on track one, which is to say, perhaps, drawing the attention of the people of Venezuela to the fact that the international system is prepared to provide them valuable, crucial, essential humanitarian assistance, mm-hmm. but the government will not allow it to come in. I could see that as being something that encourages an outcome, but by the same token is getting ready for a response. But there are other elements to this as well, which then gets you to the issue of where are we on the mafia state, the penetration by organized criminal elements of every institution, every relevant institution in Venezuela. And my guess would be, we haven't advanced far enough down the planning process yet to reach conclusions, but my guess would be there would have to be some form of international component in the early stages, some means where international law enforcement, international regulatory institutions, through some international organization, OAS, United Nations, something created specifically to deal with Venezuela. There are a number of possibilities, but something that would at least provide oversight and the initial burst of confidence for those in Venezuela that this is not the same guys doing what they have been doing for the last 20 years, or alternatively, a brand new set of guys that are going to do exactly the same thing as the people we just kicked out of office, hypothetically speaking. I see something required in that regard. I don't know how detailed it would be. I participated in such efforts in years past because I've been involved in INL often enough to see how we did it in Haiti, how we did it in East Timor, how we did it in Kosovo, how we did it in Bosnia. These were not examples of perfect engagement. We learn lessons at each stage. I would say Venezuela would be far more complicated than any of the four examples I just offered. In fact, they would be more complicated than all four of those examples combined in terms of size of economy, numbers of institutions involved, sophistication of its key economic driver, the oil industry and PDVSA. It would take all of the previous kind of rule of law and law enforcement international engagements of the past, and it would be far more complicated than any that they have done before. That's the best answer I can give you right now, although I do say anyone who is involved in planning for the day after has to treat this as one of the essential elements for such planning. It's not just political resolution and democracy, security on the streets, food, medical is also very much restoring the rule of law institutions of Venezuela.
Yeah, and the same that Venezuela cannot do it today itself, and it will not be able to do it itself during the day after. So the role of the international community is going to be more than crucial for that purpose. Thank you for all being patient. Let's get, we have two colleagues who are gonna hand you the microphone. Just identify yourself, say your name and your affiliation, and just go straight to the question, please. Yeah, I have Pedro, I have Keith here. Yeah, one on one. Let's get two questions now, and then we'll see how we go.
Pedro Urelli. I just wanted to go a little bit further, Ambassador Brownfield, and also Juan, to go in exactly the point that you ended. The international community has been focused on Venezuela and its shift from trying to force a dialogue or participate in a dialogue to try to encourage the opposition to unite, and now obviously very concerned about the consequences of the refugee crisis. But I don't see them involved in this kind of conversation. I do not see the Group of Lima talking about this. I don't see the people being very vocal about this. And as you describe this mafia state, what I would like to know is, what should the conversation be? I mean, what? Because governability and the ability to solve the problems actually revolve around solving this problem. I mean, you can take the most united opposition, put it there, and it wouldn't last a minute if the narco or mafia state moves against that transitional government. So can we go a little bit deeper as to what the conversation should be, what the preparation should be, and what does the international community assistance really look like, maybe using Plan Colombia as a comparison, which is right there, or the Iniciativa Mérida? You know, does that look like it, or is that tiny compared to the fact that here you have a narco state and not just narcos in the state?
Thank you, Pedro.
Keith Mines, Director of Andean Affairs at State. Just a quick question, if you could each outline the, you've both been involved in attacking mafias before, attacking cells. So as you look at this mafia state, what are the three biggest vulnerabilities that they have for those that are trying to restore democracy?
Thank you. Let's get to these questions and then we open it up for more.
Why don't you start? Let's go in reverse order. Z.
Z first. Yeah. I'm used to being last. Let me take the last question. Vulnerabilities. I think one is exposure that's happening, right? So we're not at a point now where we're debating what's happening sort of in a hidden way, right? So the U.S. government has gone all in revealing, or beginning to reveal what it knows about the regime involvement. And so that is a huge vulnerability for the regime. And you see the regime pretend like it doesn't matter to them, but it does, right? It does when they're listed, it does when they're indicted, it does. So the element of exposure is a key component here. A second vulnerability is, and it goes, Pedro, a little bit to your question, You still haven't seen a fully galvanized sort of regional approach to dealing with the criminality. So if the argument and the theory of the case is this is a criminal state with regional implications, where is the regional kind of law enforcement response? Mm-hmm. And you know the cases in the past when Venezuelan officials have been sent back to Venezuela to a hero's welcome instead of sent to a jail cell in New York is a real problem, right? But it's also a vulnerability, because if you are able to galvanize an international approach through INL funding or other mechanisms to actually begin to enforce the law against these regime members as they travel, not just to Miami, but to Aruba or to Peru or anywhere else, that then becomes a vulnerability. The third is, this is a regime that continues to try to profit and continues to try to move its money in ways to preserve itself. And so in doing that, this is where the tools of financial pressure that have ties to the regional and financial system matter, because the regime is going to need financing. It will need bank accounts. It will need, you know, we're not talking about Hawaladars in you know, Western Pakistan or Eastern Afghanistan that are just dealing in cash. We're talking about real estate investments. We're talking about front companies. We're talking about elements of a financial system that we can touch and influence and affect. And again, Pedro, to your question, this is a part of the sanctions regime that has not been fully sort of brought to force. There's been very good statements from the Lima Group and others about sort of applying financial pressure, but you haven't seen the full force and weight of the region actually on the strategy. And maybe just a final point, because it builds off of what Bill was saying earlier. I do think it's politically difficult from a regional perspective, Pedro, to your question about why haven't we seen it. It's politically difficult to talk about the day after, because then you're immediately accused of advocating or fomenting regime change, right, or military invasion or these kinds of things. But I do think it's critically important to not only understand the depth and breadth of the problem and what the investment will look like, because I think the investment over time will make Mérida look like a rounding error, given what we're facing here in terms of the reconstruction of Venezuela. The good news is Venezuela has human capital, has the history and tradition of institutions, albeit incredibly corrupted, has an international community that wants to help it, both public and private sector. And I think that those are great attributes upon which to build. But I think we've got to be clear about what is necessary, because it also then becomes a diplomatic tool to be able to negotiate with and around. And Bill is exactly right in that regard.
Yep. Keith, I'll start with you, because my mind obviously goes backwards rather than the same order in which questions were posed. I would try to answer your question about the three greatest vulnerabilities by saying, let's pretend I am the head of a major transnational criminal organization, a TCO, as the cool guys in INO would call them. And I would say, what is it that attracts me to Venezuela? One is the ability to take advantage of PDVSA and the financial system of Venezuela to move money and products in and out. I would say then to my people, were I still in charge of people, I'd say, let's figure out ways by which we can make that more difficult for Bill Brownfield, the head of the TCO, the Texas Criminal Organization, that would make it more difficult for him to do that sort of business in Venezuela, whether it's regulations, whether it's enhanced scrutiny, whatever it may be, that would make me say, right, it's cheaper for me to do this out of some other country or through some other country rather than Venezuela. Second, I would say that the TCO wants to move product, most likely drugs of some sort, but there are other sorts of products that can be moved through, if you will, the transportation network of Venezuela. These days, much more by sea than by air, although 10 years ago, even as you know, 7 or 8 years ago, it was overwhelmingly by air. But then what steps could we take as a government, as governments, to make that more complicated? Again, is it enhanced scrutiny and an agreement, an international agreement, that ships which have sailed from Venezuela or have connected with ships that have sailed from Venezuela will be subject to much enhanced scrutiny when they reach the next port? They will be delayed for many, many days as customs officials go over them, and if their cargo is perishable, that's a big problem for them. And what does this tell people around the world? If I'm going to do any shipping, perhaps not best not to do it in a Venezuelan vessel or a vessel that is going to or from Venezuela. In other words, make it more likely that me, the head of the Texas criminal organization, is going to say, right, let's find some other means or some other mechanism to do this. And third, I guess, to the extent that Venezuela is, among other things, a narco state. It's more than a narco state, as I believe. I think calling it a tox state sounds kind of silly, but I can live with mafia state because mafia, you know, they don't just do drugs. Remember, the godfather, Vito Corleone, did not want to get into drugs, and it practically cost him his life. He was quite comfortable doing many other things until Tartaglia, otherwise known as the pimp, and the Bronzinos, who were a tough family to be reckoned with, kind of pushed him into the business. However, drugs is part of it, and in a sense, you do have neighboring governments, two in particular, one that's fairly new that covers, I think, probably the longest part of of Venezuela's border with any other country. I refer to Colombia. And a second, which has the second longest border, I believe, with Venezuela, which is about to have a new government, and that is Brazil, might try to find ways to make me, the head of the Texas criminal organization, conclude that moving my product, if that's what I wish to do, which is to say drugs, which are for the most part, if they're plant-based drugs, they are created somewhere else and then moved and transshipped through Venezuela. If it is in fact a synthetic drug, it very likely is being produced in Venezuela itself. But what steps can I take to make those guys who are basically operating from outside Venezuela conclude better to go with some other route? That's the way I would attack the problem set. And I don't say those are the three things to attack, but I do say that is the way to figure it out. That I want to get inside the head of the chief of a criminal organization who has voluntarily decided to use Venezuela as a transit point or as a base of operations or as a financial center, and how can I make it sufficiently difficult for him, not to get him to go out of business, but to get him to go someplace else. Now, Dr. Borelli, you are, as always, if Juan is 100% correct, you're at least 99% correct. It is, of course, time to start thinking through what this means in terms of preparations for the day after. And you know, I don't want to... This is a work in progress. You know this better than I do, much better than I do. One possibility in terms of how to ensure that the issue of the complete breakdown of rule of law in Venezuela is incorporated into thinking and planning for a day after scenario. People are beginning to mutter about establishing something, whether you call it a government in exile. In fact, I would rather not call it that. I would rather call it some sort of entity that seems less threatening or frontal, but at least that could have a physical base somewhere and would have a part of it that is addressing this issue. Because at the end of the day, as you did not say, but I will say because you're smart enough to have realized this, you've got a two-part problem set the day after. One is the immediate requirement for something that establishes relative security and law enforcement starting the day after. And that almost inevitably is going to have some external component to it. Although part of the external could be Venezuelans returning to their home country, prepared to exercise some sort of role. But my guess is there's going to have to be an international component to it to at least establish some degree of confidence that this is something that the people can trust, or the businesses can trust, or the banks can trust, whoever your target audience is. Yeah. The second element is longer term. It's institutional reform. And God knows that's what I was doing for 7 years in INL. And on those, and even somebody like the good Dr. Snyder, who did it for 8 years in USAID, these things, this sort of stuff takes, it takes years. Institutions are not reformed in a matter of weeks or months. It is a matter of years. There are a number of models to do it. One of it is basically wipe out the institution and replace it in whole. Ukraine did that with their national police about 6 or 7 years ago. Worked actually surprisingly well, largely because you had a very solid and well-educated base of people that were willing to come in and be police officers, and that worked fairly well. But that's extremely risky, as you can well imagine, and normally, you wipe out the entire law enforcement establishment. You've got blipping chaos for an extended period of time. Therefore, what you're trying to do is train from the bottom up, who eventually will become mid-level and even more senior officials in a law enforcement institution. Clean out your corrupt and your irremediables. There's probably an English word for that. I can't think of what it might be. The irredeemables at the top. They go, insert some outsiders into that position, and then be forcing everyone in the middle to go through all sorts of painful reform classes and insert oversight and supervision that might get you there. But Dr. Borelli is absolutely correct. We shouldn't start thinking about this on D-Day plus one. We should start thinking about it right now. He would then say, and why haven't I actually fed him some better thoughts on this matter? But that's for another discussion and another time.
I want to be respectful of your time, but I also want to take advantage of the two gentlemen here. And let's do one more round of questions. We have three gentlemen on the front row, Dr. Snyder, Noriega, and Cardenas. And then we wrap up the event quickly. Yeah.
You have to turn to the left,
Mark. As always, the
you always look left, don't you, Mark?
As always, the distinguished panelists provide a rich environment in which one can comment. I think I would say what you have said. I agree almost 100% with everything that both have said.
That's a very frightening concept for me. I don't know about you.
However, there are some elements in the current situation which I think make it actually easier to contemplate a successful day after than either Bosnia or Kosovo or Haiti. And one of those is that
East Timor. You forgot East Timor.
I forgot East Timor. And East Timor. And that is that none of those countries had an economic resource capable of ultimately providing the basis for economic growth. Mm-hmm. And obviously Venezuela does. And the other is that I do think that today you have a region which is far more ready to consider and support significant actions aimed at getting to the day after than I could ever recall in this region in any case. And thus the possibility of getting support for the kind of action that you suggested is necessary in order to reduce the time when that day after comes. And here I think the issue of what you do with respect to the oil industry is key. Right. And I think that there are many of the new governments in the region who are ready to contemplate that, partly for their own interest. They don't want to see a doubling of the 2 million refugees that they have to deal with over the next 1 to 2 years. So I do think that's different.
Thank you, Mark. Yeah, Roger.
Yeah, thank you very much, Roger Noriega with the American Enterprise Institute. Moises, congratulations for this great panel.
Thank you. And
there's a lot of agreement among the gringos here, at least, about finally about what the challenge is all about.
And how you're not going to agree with Mark as well, are you? That would really terrify me, Roger.
Well, it'll terrify him as well. I do agree completely with what as I have for a good number of years. And we're all recognizing now this is a criminal regime, and it's led by people who at a certain point made the decision that they were going to end their lives in an early grave or in an American prison. And I, one thing I will disagree with you, Bill, is still mentioning dialogue as a possibility, yep, as a tactic that should be considered.
I hope, yep, okay, I'm with you, sorry.
Okay, so, but I wanted, my question's about tactics. The DEA and the Department of Justice, U.S. attorneys in four jurisdictions at least have thousands of person hours in on investigating leaders of this regime. Some of them probably, some of these leaders have probably been indicted and they're sealed, mm-hmm, indictments. As part of generating an international recognition of what we're up against, the very unique challenge, should we, you know, how do we go about encouraging justice, the U.S. attorneys in these jurisdictions, to unseal those indictments or issue indictments, mm-hmm, against the leaders of this regime, mm-hmm, so that people who, you know, people who have sympathies for the idea of respecting government, even a de facto government's authority, realize that we're dealing with a criminal regime, very something very different. And second question, there are functioning institutions. There's the National Assembly whose legitimacy is recognized, mm-hmm, and a Tribunal Supremo de Justicia, mm-hmm, that is operating in exile now, forced exile. They all had to run out of the country. Distinguished jurists, mm-hmm, who have, among other things, condemned Maduro to 18 years in jail for corruption and declared that there's a vacancy in the presidency. Do you see practical advantages of, first off, the U.S. government recognizing the legitimacy of those judgments and also moving forward on the Department of Justice actions against the leaders of the regime?
Thank you, Ambassador. Yeah, that's it.
Thank you. Just a very quick question. We've been talking about the day after. I wanted to ask Bill about the day of. And that even the day of is no certainty. Obviously, we know that Cuba has muddled through for decades with a bankrupt economy and exiling the discontented. The day of can take very, very different actions. And what we're looking at is probably an indigenous attempt to depose the regime. And that's going to create a lot of pressures on U.S. policy. Can you talk about the day of and the various contingencies that would exist that would obviously impact the situation, a failed attempt, a successful attempt to depose the regime? What does the U.S. do?
Thank you. Juan, if you don't mind starting with you, and then I know the ambassador wants likes to finish last.
With a flourish. You're always fancy with a flourish.
Last time I did it with a Latin expression.
Let me go to Roger's question, because it melds with a couple of thoughts that I had, given the discussion we've had today. And again, Moises, thank you for hosting this. Roger, I think you asked a really good question, because I think part of where we are now is if there's an agreement on what we're facing with in terms of the criminality of the regime, there has to be in some ways a different enforcement paradigm that we're applying, right? We have to maybe think beyond the case by case, the designation by designation model. And here I'm thinking a little bit out loud with you, because I think to encourage what would be a much more aggressive approach from the US, it would be in part to convert what are maybe sealed indictments into designations, right? So that's an easy kind of transition. Maybe looking at the regime as a conspiracy itself, right? So defining the regime itself as a conspiracy. And then you can do all sorts of things using RICO laws and other things to look at and even investigate those that are associated with the regime. Looking at what a regional approach looks like, right? So what are we doing actually to build joint cases aggressively, right, as a country? So I think that's interesting. And maybe the most provocative of thoughts, but maybe important in light of what we were talking about earlier, is do you begin to think about a truth and reconciliation-like committee? That is to say, the day after judicial framework that then begins to get you to questions like, what are judicial authorities either in Venezuela or outside of Venezuela doing? What have they concluded? What are those institutions able to do? What does the international community need to do in terms of judgment? And what does that mean for a political transition? And if you begin to talk about it in those terms, it looks like a very different kind of environment, right? You say, look, this looks like a Truth and Reconciliation Committee, a la what we saw in South Africa, for example. That actually changes the way you think about how should we think about the institutions before and after? How do we think about the cases we build? What are the charges that we're bringing, right, beyond narcotics trafficking to war crimes and human rights abuses, right? And that maybe is an argument for a very different enforcement paradigm that builds off of what has already been done, but gets a much more aggressive posture and a much more regional approach to what we're doing.
Yep. Let me knock off briefly, and I will go from my right to the left, because that is the order in which the comments and suggestions and even implied criticism was offered. Dr. Snyder, you are right, I believe, in terms of some of the differences between Venezuela and other, I guess we call them failed state exercises of the last 25 years. I might add the presence of a fairly sophisticated baseball organization in Venezuela is yet another change, and it might be the basis for some sort of additional initiative. But I will. You didn't bring that up, so I will not address it. Yes, there undoubtedly is a potential economic driver in Venezuela that very few other countries in the world have. It does not simplify the process, however, for transition. In some ways, it makes it that much more complicated. I worked for a year, my last year, although I'll not name any names, for an individual who actually knew the oil industry exceptionally well. And he would occasionally talk to me because I bet, unlike everyone else in this room, with the exception perhaps of one, I did spend a year of my life working for the Gulf Oil Company, which no longer exists, in West Texas, and learned something about the oil industry. And that is, it is an industry that definitely, I mean, even when it's working well, they've got to think about 5 years down the road, because the number of things that have to be done between where you are right now and where you have oil that is coming up out of a well and being inserted into an economic distribution system is a multi-step exercise. So if we assume on D-Day you find PDVSA in the condition in which it is, that's not an immediate short-term solution to anything, frankly, other than, I suppose, getting yet more loans. And I'm afraid they're already so tapped out on loans to China, from China and Russia right now, that you'd have to play that one very carefully. You are correct. You are also correct about greater regional enthusiasm. I've never seen this in this region on such a sensitive issue, I think. I guess in my professional life, and I acknowledge, as both you and I believe Dr. Borelli have suggested, the real driver, of course, is millions and millions of Venezuelan citizens who have now hit the road and are turning into refugees. That has caught their attention.
Can I just interrupt for just a half second? For those maybe watching who don't understand the relevance of this to the U.S., you're watching the baseball playoffs. You're going to see a Citgo sign over Fenway, over the Green Monster. Citgo, obviously, is part of PDVSA. We are cabining the profits of Citgo in the U.S., and it becomes an asset, potentially, in a post-Maduro context of the profits and the ability to engage the debt markets, et cetera. When you have that opportunity, so the relevance is mm-hmm. sits right amidst us in terms of Citgo, yes. et cetera.
And the Citgo station that used to be located approximately 1/2 mile due south of the Pentagon is no longer there, and I take no position on that issue whatsoever. Dr. Noriega, when I said tactically in terms of dialogue, I did not mean to suggest any strategic support for dialogue. My view on dialogue was the last real shot at that was probably about the first 5 years of this century. I think since then it has been a mistake, a mistake, a mistake. When should indictments be unsealed and notified? In my humble opinion, it should be done whenever the United States attorney for that particular district says in his or her prosecutorial judgment, this is the time to unseal an indictment. Now, should it be pre-notified and allow those involved in international relations and foreign development efforts and financial sanctioning decisions, and for that matter, I suppose, law enforcement and security decisions? Yes, of course. And someone should have an opportunity to express a view as to why, in fact, this should be postponed for a period of time. But I believe the decision-making authority should shift from a seemingly endless number of interagency meetings, which is what it has been for most of the last 10 years, and should in fact lie with the United States attorney, and the responsibility is of the other U.S. government player to explain to him or her and convince him or her as to why this should be postponed or not unsealed at this particular point in time. Dr. C, the day of, look, we know, I suggest we know one way how not, how the United States government should not respond to a potential D-Day scenario. We saw that in, I guess it was April maybe of 2002. And if anyone is interested in terms of how not to engage as a government, that would be a good case study. I will oversimplify, but I would suggest at that point that the problem was we waited too long before making a decision and announcing it. By so doing, within a matter of, I guess it was less than 24 hours, the government that we had announced our recognition of ceased to exist, and we therefore managed successfully to infuriate both sides of the House. One side that believes that they failed to succeed because we waited too long before offering any support at all, and the other which concluded that clearly we're dead set against them. I don't want to suggest, in fact, I'll make this statement absolutely clearly, and I'm not a member of the United States government any longer, so I could express my views, Dr. Mines, but I'm not going to, because there is no manual which says this is how you do it. I mean, you know as well as I do, everyone in this room knows, you build a plan, you spend 150 days developing a 5,000-page, 262-step plan on how to get there, and then as soon as something happens, you discover, as that guy Clausewitz said about 200 years ago, no plan survives first contact with the, I don't want to say enemy, but with the adversary, with the reality that you're going to be dealing with. What you want to do is one, think through as many of the scenarios as possible, because something similar to one of them is going to come to pass. Second, have established some of your go-to people. Go-to people perhaps on the opposition side. Go-to people in terms of the broader international community. And ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have to swallow hard and figure, who are there any go-to people that are currently in the government of Venezuela that are perhaps somewhat less repulsive, criminal, corrupt than others, and might thereby be an individual that you could in some way have a discussion, not a dialogue, a discussion with on D-Day in terms of what is happening. Thinking those things out is a good idea. Having pre-positioned assets, by which I mean humanitarian assistance type assets, having a pre-existing relationship with certain certain institutions. There's one that I have mentioned several times in public settings that still functions in Venezuela. It is part of a large multinational institution. It is headquartered in Vatican City, right in the middle of Rome. And is there some means by which maybe, and keep governments out of it, I'm all in favor of that, but you know, they got branch offices in a lot of countries around the world, and you could perhaps have some sort of discussion and understanding as to what might happen there on D-Day. Would that be a relatively trusted institution in terms of delivering humanitarian assistance, in terms of delivering whatever the international community might be able or ready to do? But I close by saying to you, the one thing I am absolutely certain of is whatever the scenario is that we build, however it is that we are convinced, this government will finally change, that is not what will happen, that it will happen in a different sort of way. I am now done, Dr. Rendon.
Ambassador Juan, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you, everybody, for coming. Thank you both again.
You're not supposed to.